Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Let's say it's day one of your new diet. You wake up feeling motivated and decide to eat a healthy breakfast of fat-free, fruit-on-the-bottom yogurt, a banana, and 8 ounces of orange juice. The problem is, it's 8:30 a.m. and you've already consumed 62 grams of sugar. That's the equivalent of 5 chocolate frosted donuts. So much for the diet. My first guest says sugar has us hooked to the foods that sap our energy and make us sick, and it's lurking where we least expect. She's a neuroscientist and co-author of the book Why Diets Fail. She's on the phone from New Jersey. Welcome to the show, Dr. Nicole Avena. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
You're a neuroscientist and you study addiction. What does that have to do with eating?
Well, it's actually becoming pretty clear that there's a lot of overlaps in our brain that relate to not only addiction, but also to food intake and eating. And so I've been interested in trying to understand what is it about certain types of foods that causes so many people to have a hard time controlling their intake of them, and what is it about the good taste and the palatability of those foods that makes us just, you know, seemingly want to continuously eat them. And so we've been doing research looking at brain reward systems, and it turns out that the studies are suggesting that the areas of the brain that are activated by drugs can also be activated by eating excessive amounts of sugars.
Right. Sugar is the big bad boy here. There's been a lot of research about sugar's addictive qualities. It's not very different from cocaine, right?
Yeah, there's actually been a lot of research that's been going on trying to look at different properties associated with addiction. And so there's lots of things associated with addictive behaviors. There's tolerance, which is when someone's addicted to alcohol, for instance, they need to continue to drink more and more and more alcohol over time in order to feel those same euphoric effects that they used to maybe get from one or two alcoholic beverages. There's signs of withdrawal that can emerge during addiction. And so if you take the drug away, the person or a laboratory animal even will show signs of distress and anxiety and just a really negative affect. There's also craving that can emerge. And these classic behaviors that are associated with addiction have also been found in response to sugar. And so it's really interesting to look at the research that's going on and see these overlaps that are occurring, not only in terms of the behaviors that these foods can elicit, but also in terms of what they can do to the brain.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. Nicole Avena. She's a neuroscientist and co-author of the book Why Diets Fail. Let's look at the foods in that breakfast I mentioned a little bit ago, yogurt, banana, and OJ. What's wrong with that?
Well, those are all seemingly healthy items to eat, and certainly there are less healthy options out there that one can choose. The problem is that when we look at the ingredients in those food items, if you turn the labels over and look on the back, you'll see that if you add up the amount of added sugars in those items, it can be astronomical. It can be much, much more than you had initially intended. And so drinking things like orange juice, they seem to be healthy because it's a fruit juice, but it turns out that there's often sugar that's added to things like that. So not only are you getting the sugar that occurs naturally from the oranges, but you're also getting added sugar that's been put in to make it taste even better.
So if, first of all, you have to identify that sugar's a problem for you.
Yes, and so for most Americans, actually, you know, have been found to be eating way too much sugar. Mm-hmm. The average American is eating 22 added teaspoons of sugar each day. And so this isn't, you know, naturally occurring sugar that you'd get if you bit into an apple or, you know, had some carrots. I'm talking about sugar that's added into the food on top of what's already in there naturally. And that's much more than the medical guidelines recommend we consume. So most of us are eating too much sugar to begin with, and many of us have a problem with it, meaning that it's very hard to control our intake. Often people will say that they feel compelled to overeat sugar-rich foods. They feel drawn to them. They feel that they can't control or limit their intake. So identifying whether or not you are one of those individuals who has a hard time putting the brakes on your intake of sugar is really the first step.
fruit like that banana, it may be high in sugar, but it has a lot of vitamins and fiber and other stuff that's good for us. What's your take on fruit? Because when I look at that list in your book on page 128, the sugar equivalency, bananas aren't so bad.
Right. And so there are certainly foods that contain sugars that occur naturally that are good options to eat. If you're going to eat some sugars, I would certainly advocate getting them from natural sources like fruits. But there are a couple of things to consider. First, fruits are good because they do contain some sugars, but they also contain fiber. Mm-hmm. They also contain lots of other nutrients that we need. And so having the fiber included with the sugar helps to not only aid in digestion, but it also helps to mitigate that spike in blood glucose levels that we would get from the sugar that's occurring in the fruits. And so having the fiber and the other nutrients built in can really help, even though it does contain sugar. One thing you want to think about with fruits, though, is that you want to make sure you're using whole fruits, because often if you take the fruit and juice it and just take out all the pulp and all the other things, you're getting rid of that fiber and you're getting rid of some of those nutrients. And what you're really essentially doing is concentrating the fruit down just to the juice, which really is just containing all the sugar. So you're making a much more concentrated sugar form of the juice. So that's important to remember.
I thought it was interesting how many grams of sugar were in raisins.
Yes. So thinking about fruits, we also want to make sure, again, this gets back to reasons why it's good to eat whole fruits.
So raisins, and fresh fruit.
And fresh fruits. Mm-hmm. Raisins are dehydrated. And so basically, they've been shrunken down and had a lot of these, you know, essential nutrients that we would normally see in a grape taken out of them. And so through that dehydration process, we get our raisin to form, but we're also then concentrating the amount of sugar into a much smaller volume.
And eating more of them often.
Exactly. And it's much easier to eat a lot of raisins than it is to eat just a handful of grapes.
You are, what are some better breakfast choices then? We often associate what I mentioned, yogurt, a banana, and OJ. I don't happen to eat that way. I eat oatmeal most mornings.
Right. Well, some other ideas. In the book, there's a lot of different solutions that are offered for people to try to figure out what they should eat. Because if you do self-identify as being someone who is addicted to sugar and you're working to try to get it out of your diet or minimize it in your diet, you need to have some solutions on what you can eat instead. And so some ideas in the book that we talk about are looking at things like eggs, for instance. Eggs can be a very healthy breakfast option. They can be quick and easy, just like I think many people opt for things like a yogurt and a banana for breakfast because you can grab them and eat them in your car if you want to. You can also hard-boil eggs and eat them in your car. And so there are other options out there that are less carbohydrate and sugar dense and more dense in other types of nutrients.
Tell us how sugar, you talk about, write about how it changes our brain. So we're talking about back to that addiction issue again and how it actually changes our brain. And you mentioned withdrawal symptoms as with drug addiction. Sugar has the same kind of withdrawal symptoms?
Yes. And so there's been some studies that have gone on in my laboratory looking at animal models. And what we found is that we have our lab rats, and if we let them have access to sugar and let them drink excessive amounts of it, and then we take that sugar away, those animals will show signs of anxiety, signs of distress. They will show signs of withdrawal that emerge when you would see an animal who is dependent on a drug like morphine go into withdrawal. And so there's similarities that exist between the state that emerges when the animal is taken off of sugar and what happens when an animal is taken off of a drug. And many individuals report similar types of experiences. If you think about it, if someone starts a new healthy eating pattern and they decide to cut out processed junk food and they're going to, you know, start today is the day they're going to start their diet and they're eating healthy, a lot of reasons why diets fail, and this is part of the reason why we decided to name the book Why Diets Fail, is because people can maintain a healthy eating pattern for a couple of days, it seems, but then something happens and it just becomes so difficult. People report that they start to feel lethargic and tired and irritable and cranky. And many people think that that's their body's way of telling them that they're hungry or that their blood sugar is too low and they need to eat. But in reality, it might just be that they're in withdrawal, because those are all signs and symptoms that can be associated with withdrawal. And so by acknowledging that and recognizing that, it can really help people to understand what the experience is that they're undergoing and to be able to move past it, because withdrawal is a very acute phase. It's not fun, but it is acute, and it will only last a few days to a week before those negative feelings start to go away and things will get easier.
In your book, you propose a sugar freedom plan. How does that differ from other low sugar diets?
Right. Well, one of the problems I think with a lot of the other low sugar diets out there is that it's too much too soon. The whole idea is that you're supposed to go off of sugar immediately and cut it out. And I think for many people, that's just completely overwhelming and daunting, partly because many people don't realize where sugar is and all the different sources of sugar that we have in our diet. So, for instance, it's pretty obvious that if you're trying to eat a low-sugar diet, you shouldn't have cakes and cookies. But what about salad dressing? What about barbecue sauce? What about things like salami? These are all foods that don't necessarily look like they would have sugar in them, but in fact, they do contain added sugars. And so the Sugar Freedom Plan is different in that it walks people through a series of steps that they can follow to not only identify where the sugars are in their diet, but knock them out one by one and replace them with more sensible alternatives so that they can still enjoy the foods that they're consuming, but be doing so in a way that's going to help them lessen the amount of sugar they're consuming.
No matter what, to overcome the addiction, about how long does it take?
Well, it depends. And just like with other types of addictions, it's a unique experience and it's going to be different for everybody. Mm-hmm. A lot of it's going to depend on the extent to which you're consuming excess sugars. Some people may not be heavy soda drinkers, for instance, and so cutting out sugar-sweetened beverages wouldn't be a big thing for them to do and wouldn't be very difficult. But there's many people out there who have a pretty significant soda habit who are consuming lots and lots of it. And so getting soda out of their diet and getting to the point where they feel that they're not compelled to eat it might take a little bit longer. So again, it's going to really vary on the individual. But the point is that I think people need to acknowledge that if you want to make a change and you want to eat in a way that's going to allow you to stay at a healthy body weight, it's not a quick fix. It's not a diet, meaning that you can't change the way you eat for a little while and then go back to your old habits. Mm-hmm. The reason why people have a hard time sticking to diets and the reason why they fail is because in order to sustain weight loss, to sustain this, you have to make a lifelong change. You have to change the way you eat forever and change the way you think about eating.
Dr. Nicole Avena, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
Dr. Nicole Avena is a neuroscientist and co-author of a new book. It's called Why Diets Fail. We'll continue Wellness Wednesday after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Listening to the Bee Gees doesn't just cure disco fever. It can prolong a life. The American Heart Association recommends that the chest compressions administered as part of CPR be fast and constant, like the beat of Stayin' Alive. But recently, CPR's effectiveness has been called into question. The number of lives saved by doing CPR is disappointingly low, way lower than TV medical dramas would have us believe. Joining us in the studio to talk about the ins and outs of cardiac resuscitation is Dr. Diane Gorgas, Residency Director in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Wexner Medical Center. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Now, it's Heart Health Month, and I notice you're wearing a beautiful red blouse? Is this planned or is it? It's also scarlet and gray. Is this?
I wish
Buckeye
I said it would
out?
Have some forethought. It would happen to be clean.
Right. Gotcha.
Yeah.
All right. So first of all, before we get into what's good and what's not, what is CPR? What are we doing? It's cardiopulmonary resuscitation. What does it do?
So the whole goal of CPR is to create a mechanical environment that simulates the normally beating heart. So to get a modicum of forward blood flow out of the heart to the critical organs. And the critical organ that we're talking about is the brain. The kidneys, the stomach, the bowel, the extremities can all live for much more prolonged periods of time without oxygen and blood flow than can the brain.
All right, so how does CPR work these days? We all kind of know what we think it looks like because we watch TV, but how does it really work?
TV is a good simulation of CPR, I think, but there have been some recent changes that the American Heart Association has begun to recommend because although traditional CPR with chest compressions and artificial respirations probably best replicates a spontaneous circulation, a regular beating heart with normal respirations, we've kind of backed off of that recommendation along the philosophy that the enemy of good is better. When people were trying to do artificial respiration along with chest compressions, even in the medical setting, by trained professionals that are used to doing this day in and day out, we found that there were significant interruptions in chest compressions, that there was kind of a secondary consideration of the quality of chest compressions versus respirations. And really, the message that the American Heart wanted to send forward, which I think is perfectly appropriate and has been backed by many studies, is the important thing is constant, steady, rapid chest compressions.
Staying alive.
Bee Gees. Yes.
I've read that there's a lot of data that shows still it isn't the lifesaver that we often give it credit to for being.
That's absolutely correct. It is not the lifesaver. And even more interesting, when you look at statistics from varying cities, you find that there's a wide variety of rates of successful outcome of CPR. Seattle, for example, is the city that's always held up as the paradigm of successful bystander CPR. They have about a 45% resuscitation rate when bystander CPR is given in the out-of-hospital setting in Seattle. We in Columbus have a slightly older population with more underlying medical problems, and our rate of successful bystander CPR is significantly lower. Nationwide, when you're looking at statistics, there's really only about a 3 to 6% rate of successful discharge from the hospital of those patients who receive CPR in the field.
So under what circumstances is CPR helpful then? There's only certain circumstances.
What I want to tell your listeners is that you cannot determine those situations in the field.
So you just have to go for it.
You just have to go for it. I have a passion about this. 10 years ago, my father had an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, and while he was at a health club at a gym facility, a firefighter came up and gave him bystander CPR, and he has been healthy for the last 10 years because of this. You cannot know ahead of time which patients are going to be that 6 or 10 or 40% if you happen to live in Seattle, and which patients it's going to be a futile effort on. So we want to encourage everybody. You see somebody go down, they don't have a pulse, start CPR.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. Diane Gorgas. She's residency director at the Department of Emergency Medicine at Wexner Medical Center. We're talking about CPR. We're talking about a healthy heart. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. The first thing we're supposed to do if someone collapses is call 911.
Absolutely.
People who learned CPR before 2008 learned a combination of chest compressions and mouth-to-mouth breathing, but the Heart Association stopped recommending the breathing, so it's hands only. Why is that?
There are a couple of reasons. One is participation. When you asked people in the community, why wouldn't you give CPR to somebody? The answer is always, I'm not going to walk up to a stranger and give them mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. The second reason for that is that we know that there's, in the adult population, not in pediatrics, but in the adult population over the age of 18, the primary reason that people go into cardiac arrest is a cardiac reason. It's a heart reason. Because of that, it's a sudden stop of the heartbeat. And there is usually enough oxygen in the bloodstream that if we can just recirculate the blood, if we can just create a mechanical pulse by doing chest compressions, that there will be enough oxygen for a number of minutes to sustain normal function of the brain.
You're not necessarily trying to start the heart up again on its own.
You are almost never going to be successful at starting
It'll
the heart up on its own.
It'll keep you alive long enough for somebody to save you.
For paramedics to get there, or for an external defibrillator to get there. There are lots of places where we have external defibrillators, automated external defibrillators in Columbus now. And it's that electricity that will typically get the heart restarted in spontaneous rhythm.
Are there some situations where people need the breathing?
There are those adult situations. They're the exception to the rule. The rule in pediatrics, though, is the reason that children's hearts stop beating is almost always from a primary respiratory cause. That's why we still recommend mouth-to-mouth rescue breathing in anybody under the age of 18. If you can restore respiration, the heart will generally start beating on its own.
The Heart Association is very specific in their call for high-quality chest compressions for CPR, and we were talking earlier. Is the high quality, is that a function of the repetitiveness of it, or is there a quality to the compression?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
So compressions need to be fast to the beat of staying alive, and most people that we see administering compressions ineffectively, it's because it's too slow, not too fast. But if you keep that song in your head, that's a good metric for it. There's also ineffective compressions in that people stop frequently to do pulse checks, to do mouth-to-mouth breathing, to put the patient's legs up, to do whatever they're doing. And we want continuous compressions until medical help arrives. And the third way that compressions can be done inadequately is to not have sufficient depth of the compressions. You really have to push pretty hard. It's 5 centimeters or about 2 inches that you want to depress the sternum to get adequate blood flow.
That sounds like you could almost be breaking things.
You absolutely can be breaking things. And what we've discovered looking at CPR that's been done on thousands of patients over the years is that we have a finite risk of breaking ribs. Broken ribs will never heal if there's not a heartbeat, though. So restoring that circulation, we know that the ribs can heal over time. We haven't seen any cases of cardiac puncture or lung puncture or blood accumulating in the chest. Those are very rare if they ever occur.
You recently wrote an article in the Dispatch called Some Types of Cardiac Arrest Are Scarier Than Others. What types are scarier? Or do we need to even know about them?
I think it's a realistic bit of knowledge.
Okay.
From a bystander participation point of view, cardiac arrest is cardiac arrest. You resuscitate them all the same way. You do chest compressions in all these patients. But when these patients come into the emergency department and we look at the rhythm that their heart is in, the most successful types of resuscitation occur when the heart's initial rhythm is ventricular fibrillation or when the primary problem is an abnormal rhythm of the heart. If you get somebody that goes flatline or asystolic, those are very difficult patients to come back. An equally difficult group of patients to come back is the pulseless electrical activity patients, where you look at the EKG, it looks completely normal electrically, but the patient has no pulse and they're in arrest. There's a whole litany of reasons that this could happen, from metabolic derangements to hypothermia to blockages of blood leaving the heart, like a collection of air outside of the lung or a collection of fluid around the heart. Or in the case that I wrote about recently, it was a patient who had shock from internal bleeding. And that can present as a PEA type of cardiac arrest.
Can a layperson tell what has caused someone's pulse to stop? Or are we going back to the same issue of if it stopped, start the compressions?
There can be some clues that...
You might have watched something happen.
Right. You may have watched something happen. Typically, those tend to be environmental forces where you can actually... There are external forces that happen on the patient. If somebody's electrocuted, you may know why the heart is stopped for that reason. If somebody has obvious source of bleeding, if it's because of trauma, you may be able to tell why the heart has stopped. In the vast majority of cases, when patients come to the emergency department, either after return of spontaneous circulation from cardiac arrest or still in cardiac arrest, we as medical professionals don't know why that happened. So I would say that the unifying message is don't worry about it. It's not a consideration for why the heart stopped. The pathway for action is the same, and that's always CPR.
I think most of us have heard that taking aspirin can be good for our heart. How does that work, that a painkiller reduces the risk of a heart attack, and is that still commonly accepted?
It is still commonly accepted. It's one of the oldest therapies available and really one of the most effective. It decreases inflammation, which actually decreases the amount of plaque deposited on the walls of the coronary arteries. It makes the blood a little slipperier. It doesn't make it thinner like many blood thinners that you think of to the extent of Coumadin or warfarin or anything like that. But it does make it slipperier so it can float past obstructions better. But the inflammation is really the key part of aspirin therapy.
So should everybody be taking an aspirin a day?
There's almost never an always and almost never a never in medicine.
Right.
And there are certainly patients who cannot tolerate aspirin therapy. Those that have a history of ulcer disease or upper GI bleeds or true allergies associated with aspirin should not be on aspirin. But a lot of patients who have either significant risk factors for heart disease or have known and established heart disease, coronary artery narrowing, they can get tremendous benefit from taking aspirin.
What else would you like to tell people about CPR? Because a lot of people, I don't know how many, if the states, if when you're looking at those rates of resuscitation and success rates, compare, does that have anything to do with rates of training people?
Absolutely, that an educated population when it comes to CPR is always going to be associated with better outcomes. So one of the questions that the American Heart Association struggled with when they recommended hands-only CPR was, well, we have a subset of the population, bystanders, that we've already trained in mouth-to-mouth resuscitation as well as CPR. Do we tell those folks, don't worry about mouth-to-mouth breathing? Just do the hands-only CPR. Bottom line, if you're comfortable doing mouth-to-mouth resuscitation along with chest compressions, or if you have two people that are trained, it's always going to be better to do mouth-to-mouth breathing and chest compressions. But even bystanders that have had no training in CPR can be talked through by a 911 operator the mechanics of giving chest compressions.
And they will do that, the 911s.
Absolutely, they will do that.
What about, does it matter if you know that it's a heart attack? I mean, what are the signs of a heart attack?
So typically people will have crushing center of their chest, just below their breastbone type of pain associated with this. It may move to the jaw. It may move to the left arm. It may move to the right arm. They can break out in a sweat. They can become sick to their stomach. They can have shortness of breath associated with it. All of that textbook presentation of a heart attack was pretty much based on studies done on men. Mm-hmm. We know that women have much different symptoms when they have a heart attack. They can present typically like men present with a heart attack, but with women it can be as simple as fatigue, sleepiness.
Why is that? Why are they so different?
Viva la difference. there is a number of reasons why women...
Sounds like we're more easygoing about the whole thing.
Yes, we just don't complain about it. Quite seriously, there are hormonal differences, but there are also hardwired neurologic differences in the way that men and women perceive pain. And women may perceive heart pain quite differently.
Maury in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Diane Gorgas. Hi, Maury.
Hi, good morning, Ann. Thanks for taking the call. I'm a 911 dispatcher. I've been a dispatcher for 15 years, and I wanted to kind of reaffirm what Dr. Gorgas was saying about bystander CPR and their resistance to mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. What we found is that when somebody called 911 for someone who's had a cardiac arrest, when we even talk about trying to do mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, they are just most times completely opposed to that. They don't know the person, or they don't want to get involved, or whatever the reason. But we found with chest compressions, they're far more willing to help out, and they see that as kind of a, you know, I can help but not really put myself at risk type event. The other thing I was going to add to is that when there's more than one person there who's, you know, aiding the victim, if one person is continually doing the CPR, and like the doctor said, the dispatcher can talk them through that, another person can be sent to someplace else in the building to meet the responders that are coming in, you know, in places where there are big buildings like shopping centers or schools or other large complexes. It can be hard for responders coming in to find exactly where the patient is. So if one person can be working on doing compressions and CPR, a second person can be sent to maybe a main entrance or an immediate exit door to be able to flag down responders that are coming in.
You sound like a dispatcher.
He does.
I don't know why, but you do. So you're a dispatcher, but you're an EMS dispatcher. Do you have special training?
Yes, ma'am. I'm a fire and EMS dispatcher, and the training that we go through for our side in communications is pretty equivalent to what responders get when they're, you know, coming to your scene. Difference for us is that we have to learn to kind of talk someone through doing what we would do if we were on the scene. So it's kind of akin to having a blindfold on and trying to do something, you know, without being able to see it. So you have to make the caller become your hands or, you know, you on the scene before responders get there.
Well, Maury, thanks for doing what you do, and thanks for your call.
Thank you for taking the call. Thank you.
You bet. Diane Gorgas, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Ann.
Dr. Diane Gorgas, Residency Director of the Department of Emergency Medicine at Wexner Medical Center. Coming up, we're going to be talking about, well, speaking of the differences between women and men in pain, we're going to be talking with a medical journalist and the author of Nation in Pain. And we'll get a little bit more into those weeds when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Well, it's all in your mind. It's all in your mind. Well, it's all in your mind. It's all in your mind.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. 100 million Americans suffer from chronic pain, and for many of them, the refrain, "It's all in your mind," is all too familiar. The fact is, it is in your mind, but it doesn't mean it doesn't hurt. Journalist Judy Foreman has written about this in a new book called A Nation in Pain, Healing Our Biggest Health Problem. And she joins us by phone from Boston. Welcome to the show, Judy Foreman.
Thanks so much.
So you call it our biggest health problem. How is pain a health problem? A lot of people associate it with a symptom.
Yeah, well, the new, or not so new, thinking is that chronic pain is a disease unto itself. It can be a disease of the nervous system, not just a symptom of an infection or a tumor or something else. That when it lasts for more than 3 to 6 months, the nervous system literally biologically changes, transforms, and becomes revved up. It's kind of like a runaway freight train. And it becomes, in that case, you know, pain is really its own disease. It becomes an entity that is separate from the original cause. It's own disease, basically.
So I said earlier, it is in our minds. That's where pain is processed, and it's also completely real.
Yes. Well, we can get very philosophical about minds and brains and things.
Uh-huh.
Pain is felt in the brain. That's completely right. But that doesn't mean you're making it up. That's sort of the important distinction, that you're not causing your pain. You know, you yourself by your thoughts or whatever are not really causing your pain. The pain is very real, and it is felt in the brain, which is, you know, you can call the mind if you like. But, yeah, the pain, what happens is the signals, which are sort of electrical and chemical signals, travel along nerves up through the spinal cord into the brain, and the signals spread out to various sections of the brain. So we have kind of a sensory processing center where we are kind of become aware of what's happening in terms of the basic sensory feeling. And then it also goes to cognitive and emotional centers in the brain so that we have, you know, without trying to, we have an emotional reaction to the pain. That's part and parcel of the whole experience. So yes, pain is felt in the brain, but it is very, very, very real.
Again, it's our biggest health problem, affects about one-third of the country's adults, but chronic pain gets less attention in medical schools than it does in veterinary schools. Why?
Yes, I shouldn't laugh because it's really a serious
That's
problem.
Okay.
But there was a big study from Johns Hopkins University in 2011 that looked at 117 medical schools in the U.S. and Canada, and it found that the median, essentially the average number of hours in medical schools that med students got on pain education was 9. And other studies found that in veterinary schools, the students get much more than that. So it's really crazy. You know, people who are going to take care of animals, worthy as that is, mm-hmm. learn more about pain than people who are going to be taking care of people. It's completely crazy. And the result is, obviously, as any pain patient knows, when you go to the doctor, things that doctors don't understand, they tend to dismiss as all in your mind. And they frankly don't always know, or often don't know, what to do to help you with your pain.
Can you look at a brain scan and see if somebody's in pain?
Great question. The short answer is basically yes, you can. And that's an increasingly important thing. There's a type of brain scan called F as in functional MRI, magnetic resonance imaging. And these brain scans can tell in real time, like in the moment, where in the brain the person is processing pain. You know, these machines are expensive, so they're not in every doctor's office. So you can't just walk in and say, you know, I want to prove to you, doc, that I'm really in pain, and plug yourself into the machine and get the answer. And, you know, this very sophisticated technology, and it's not yet being used routinely as a diagnostic test for pain, but it is heading in that direction. And it's very good news because doctors and researchers can tell by these brain scans which parts of the brain are involved. And there is a lot of data showing that people who are in chronic pain for a long time, their brains actually change. The volume of tissue decreases, and that can be equivalent to 20 years of aging. So chronic pain literally ages the brain.
What is chronic pain? How do you define it?
Okay. Well, let me just start with pain per se.
Okay.
This is the official definition, and it's kind of wordy, but here we go. An unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage or described in terms of such damage. And that definition comes from an academic group with 9,000 neuroscientists called the International Association for the Study of Pain. In shorthand, chronic pain is pain that lasts for 3 to 6 months or more. But as I was kind of trying to explain a few minutes ago, it's not just acute pain that lasts a long time. It's not just acute pain that doesn't go away. Chronic pain is literally a transformation of the nervous system itself. It's as if, you know, when you use your nervous system and your brain to learn French or to learn to play the piano, with practice, the nervous system gets more and more efficient at that task. Well, the same thing happens with processing of pain. The nervous system gets more and more efficient at processing these basic biochemical pain signals until it, you know, it gets very expert at it, and it becomes, as I said, like a runaway train.
I read your article for the Wall Street Journal in January. You wrote about your own, how you got interested in the topic of chronic pain the hard way.
Yeah, getting interested would be putting it mildly. Mm-hmm. I had excruciating neck pain that seemed to come out of the blue. And, you know, everybody uses this 0 to 10 scale, and mine was a 20. I mean, I had never, ever felt anything like that. And, you know, like many women, I've been through childbirth, and the differences were striking because, you know, when you're in labor about to have a baby, it really does hurt. No one argues with that. But you know it's going to be over. You know you're going to get a baby out of it. And no one tells you it's all in your mind. And everybody understands where the pain is coming from. With most of the chronic pain that these 100 million Americans are struggling with, the cause is often very unclear. The end is often not in sight, and people are often told that it's in their head. And I don't know whether you want to get into the gender differences in pain.
Yes,
but
I do.
Okay. They are very real. Until puberty, until kids become teenagers, boys and girls have roughly the same amount of pain, and not that much. You know, I mean, kids are basically pretty healthy and resilient and don't have that much pain. Once puberty hits, girls and women have much more pain than men. There was a huge survey of 85,000 people, and 45% of the women had some kind of chronic pain condition compared to only about 30% of the men. And like with migraines, women get three times as many migraines, and they get more irritable bowel syndrome, they get more fibromyalgia. And it's not always clear why, but it looks as though hormones are very probably involved, at least to some extent.
So because of these gender differences, or not because of, but the gender differences are not only in who suffers from the pain, but also in how the pain is treated.
Yes. I know you were talking earlier about heart disease and how women present their symptoms differently, not because they're trying to present them differently, but it feels different to them. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happens a lot with women. I mean, for one thing, you know, we were talking about brain scans. Women's brain scans show a somewhat different pattern. You know, the emotional centers in women's brains tend to light up more on these scans. So women are literally often feeling the pain in more emotional ways. And when they present their symptoms to the doctor in emotional terms, that's kind of a turnoff for a lot of doctors, unfortunately. It's really too bad. But there's also a number of studies that show that women are undertreated a lot of times, not always, but often, for pain. There's a couple of interesting studies using videotapes where they have sort of a standardized patient played by an actor, a male actor and a female actor, and doctors look at the tape with the person describing their chest pain, and they're much more likely to tell the male, the actor, to, you know, get treatment than the woman. So women's pain is often minimized by doctors, even though they have more of it.
Well, you said that women tend to present it more in an emotional way. What did you mean by that? Like, oh, this hurts so bad I want to kill myself? I mean, I don't know. What do you mean by that?
Well, actually, the suicide rate for people in chronic pain is twice as high as for people without pain. So that's a good point. But yes, I think a lot of times if people present their pain in very objective ways, that can be helpful because the doctors really don't like emotional presentations of things. And one thing that can help, I think, is if people kind of keep a pain diary and make note of what times of day or after what kinds of activities or rest their pain is better or worse, that kind of objectifies things and gives the doctor some clues about what might really be going on. And that can help take some of the emotionality out of the presentation to the doctor. But, you know, it's a, doctors also feel totally helpless when confronted with a person in pain because they haven't learned much about it and they don't really know what to do. And often they're very frightened of prescribing opioids or narcotics because mm-hmm. of all the regulatory scrutiny that they get. So, I mean, I don't want to take doctor's side against patients, but the doctors are in a bind with all this, too.
I had trigeminal neuralgia.
Oh.
The nickname is the suicide disease.
That's right.
And I remember a specialist said, you know, I can fix your problem. And I said, really? How? And he goes, as soon as I know what's causing it. How much of this pain and this chronic pain do we not know the cause of?
An awful lot. An awful lot. One of the patients I talk about in my book, I have a whole chapter in the book on marijuana, which I didn't initially set out to put in the book, but I was very intrigued by the scientific studies about marijuana. And I talked to a patient who did have trigeminal neuralgia. And she smoked like one puff in the morning and I think one puff in the afternoon of marijuana. And it didn't make the pain go away. The sensory signals were still getting to her brain. But she said it felt like the pain moved about a foot off her face.
Huh.
So cognitively, she knew the pain was still there. But she was able to distance herself emotionally a little bit from the pain. And that actually allowed her to get through her day. And it was very dramatic. And I've talked to other patients who have had the same experience. And as you say, it is trigeminal neuralgia is called a suicide disease. And it can be just excruciating for people.
But no one can see what's hurting you.
That's the problem with pain. People look perfectly fine. And that adds to the disbelief. You know, people say, you look fine. Why would I believe you? You know, you don't have a cast on. You're not limping.
Mm-hmm.
Being believed is a huge problem for people.
Another interesting aspect of the gender differences was when women and men with basically the same complaint came in, physicians were more likely to prescribe painkillers to men and not antidepressants, but
sedatives
to women. What was that about?
Yeah, that's actually a controversial study, but yes, it was striking that after heart surgery, men got the real painkillers and women got the equivalent of Valium. I mean, that again sort of shows the disparate treatment that men and women often get. And there's also another study that was a preliminary study in Italy a few years ago involving transgender people. And when the person went from male to female and therefore was taking estrogen to get some of the female characteristics, the level of chronic pain went up. And when it was the other way, the person went from being female to male and was therefore taking testosterone, the so-called male hormone, the pain went down. So there's a fair amount of evidence that testosterone probably protects against pain. Estrogen is a much more complicated story. Sometimes it seems to protect. Sometimes it seems to make it worse. And, of course, it fluctuates a lot over the course of the menstrual cycle and over the course of the life cycle, you know, pre- and post-menopause. And the data on estrogen don't line up nearly as neatly as the data on testosterone. So it's a very complicated thing. But it does seem to be the case that women respond differently to certain opioid drugs than mm-hmm. men do, to the point that some researchers think that someday we're going to have pink pills for women and blue pills for men. The differences are that striking.
And just briefly, the issue with the country's problem with the addiction and abuse of opioid painkillers, how much is that driving treatment of pain these days?
It's messing it up, basically, because doctors are afraid to prescribe the opioids. And in my view, we are overestimating the addiction problem and underestimating the much larger problem of chronic pain. And we're sort of, it ends up, you know, our preoccupation with the addiction problem ends up kind of punishing people with genuine pain. It's almost like there's two separate populations. Most pain patients, according to the studies that I found, do not abuse the drugs. They do not become addicted. They often can take them for many years, and the drugs just let them go to their jobs or mm-hmm. you know, take care of their families. And the people who become addicted are often a different population, mm-hmm. and they're getting the drugs illegally and they're misusing them. They're using them to get high. They're continually increasing their doses. And that's not the pattern with pain patients generally.
Judy Foreman, thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Judy Foreman, she's a medical journalist and the author of a new book. It's called Nation in Pain, Healing Our Biggest Health Problem. Thanks for joining us today on Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.